some of the labeling that we have on kids as if labeling them solves the problem.
He is the leading researcher that we love to go to, and we're bringing him to you next. It's Dr. John Hattie.
And now, it's time for another edulicious episode of the Bentley Brothers Podcast, bringing you what's current and what works in education. Here are your hosts, Scott and Tim Bentley.
Bentley Brothers, Bentley, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Bentley Brothers, yep. Bentley, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Yep.
First name Bentley, last name Brothers, bringing education information like no
other. That's right. On today's show, we have the incomparable Dr. John Hattie with us. He's driving outside of Melbourne right now, and we're going to be talking to him about some ideas on research and education. And before we get to that, though, Scott, why don't you tell our listeners about our new sponsor? We love these guys.
Yeah, you know, I started using them in my classroom last year, Tim. It's called ListenWise. And basically what they do is they bring you all this information off of NPR that you can attach right into your content. And it's all these stories. It's easy to search. And I hope people will go out and sign out and check it up. It's called ListenWise, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, I definitely love it. It's, you know, we have things like Newzilla for reading and then comprehension questions to go with that. But what about those listening skills that we're supposed to be testing kids on? I mean, the ListenWise is perfect for that because the kids listen to basically a story and then they have to answer, or they can. You can do comprehension questions based on the listening, and they're really high interest. I love what's on ListenWise. So go check them out. It's listenwise.com. Is that right, Scott?
That's right, Tim.
All righty. So, Dr. Hattie, are you there?
I'm there. Good thing.
All right. Good to talk to you again. It's been a while since we had you on the show, and your episode is one of our most listened to episodes, and people have really gotten a lot out of it. So we appreciate you joining us again here.
Well, let's see if we can do that again.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, Dr. Hattie. I have kind of what's maybe a tough question at the beginning here, so we'll start tough. How's that? How do we as teachers know what research to believe from all the research? There's so much research out there. We see articles left and right, and some of them even, or many of them even, contradict each other. How do we know what and who to believe when we're looking at research on practices that impact in our classroom?
Well, you got to start with yourself and say, I'm going to read this research. What are my quality indicators? How do I filter how credible it is? And I nearly always start by reading the conclusions first and say, what are they saying that's new, exciting, different, that surprises me? And if I am surprised or interested, then I go back and say, well, how credible is this in terms of what they've done? But the other big thing that's certainly happened over the last 30 or 40 years is the ability to synthesize what's out there. Because, of course, you're going to get people have different views, different opinions, different interpretations. So one of the synthesizers is saying, and that's been the most exciting change, I think, over the last 20 years.
Excellent.
So there's a bottom line. Now, there is a bottom line, and that is when you then apply those research in your own classroom, are you sufficiently evaluative yourself to ask, does it work for me? And that's what really matters.
I love that you said that, because that's what it's all about, I know, to Scott and me, that, you know, what results are we seeing with our kids? You know, that's what really matters, right?
Well, that's right, because, like, the work I do is really about probability. If you do these high-impact interventions that others have used, there's a higher probability that it might work with you, but you still have to check it.
Yeah, that's for sure. Now, you know, one thing that I've been kind of listening to some podcasts on and listen to research about, and it's strange because I've been teaching for 29 years, and I've just started asking myself this question: what is learning, and how do we measure it? And I don't think that question is very easy to answer. Maybe you can clear that up for me in my mind. What does it actually mean to learn something? Because the more I look at that, that's not an easy question to answer. I mean, If a kid knows something for a day, does that mean they learned it? Obviously not. But how long do they have to know it, and how do we check on whether they know it? Because we only have the kids for a year.
Well, let me answer that by asking you a question. How do you learn?
Well, all different ways, I guess, that I learn. I'm not sure.
Dr. Hattie, I would say that I learned my phone number when I was a kid, because I can still quote you back my phone number my childhood phone number. I still know that to this day. But is that the kind of learning we need to go for in content? I mean, are we, is it more skills that we need to learn? I mean, there's so many questions around learning that Tim and I have been approaching. And but yeah, that's a good question, is how did we learn something?
The point I'm making with it is that, and you guys are obviously pretty good at your job because you've switched my question and asked me a question. Let me come back to my question. When I ask what learning is, we as adults don't have a very good language. It's very hard for us to articulate it. And so it really is fascinating that that's one of the hardest things to talk about as teachers, about what learning is, but that is actually what our actual job is.
Exactly.
And so one of the things I find fascinating is that most teachers have thousands, if not tens of thousands, of assessments of achievement at their fingertips, but hardly any to understand how kids learn. And I go back to what I think what you said, Tim. Very good learners have many, many strategies, and they know when to use them, when not to use them. And we've developed a whole model around this called the Kenny Rogers model. You've got to know when to hold them, you've got to know when to play them. And that's the skill. Struggling learners typically have one or two strategies, and they keep using those strategies even if they don't work. And so our job as teachers is to listen to kids and understand how they're thinking about their learning, where they struggle, how they deal with things when they do struggle, what they do when they don't know what to do, and that's when the learning conversation needs to be held, as to how to help kids think differently about their learning. And like, I just went through about 6,000 or 7,000 hours of transcripts of teacher lessons to find examples of when teachers do that, and quite frankly, I couldn't find one. Short of a few questioning teachers asked, no, we don't have a language for it, we don't have a discussion. In most of our teacher education courses, learning has disappeared. If you ask most teachers to name two theories of learning, they can't. And Vygotsky is not a theory of learning, by the way. And so that whole discussion's gone. And that's why I'm so obsessed about the notion that we have to switch our discussions from talking about teaching to talking about learning. Because you've hit it on the nail.
You said you didn't find one example. What were you hoping to find? Because if we know what that is, then I think we can be much better teachers. What were you looking for in those transcripts?
Well, for example, as a kid starts to learn something, I want to see whether the kid is able to summarize what's happening. So what's the summary of what's going on here? What's the big idea? Because as in all things, when you learn something, incoming is coming at 10,000 miles an hour, and good learners in the early stages work out what those big ideas are. So how do teachers help kids understand those big ideas? And then you've got that notion of how do kids know how to deliberately practice? And I say deliberately practice because just practice alone doesn't cut it, because sometimes you can practice the wrong thing over and over again. So how do they know to seek help? And it's just not true that kids ask teachers.
Yeah.
They don't. Most kids don't know what to do, learn how to sit there and be passive. They learn how to turn off. Yeah. They learn how to be selective in their thing. So when does a teacher go up? When was the last time you walked into a classroom and heard kids thinking aloud? Even more so, when did you last time you walk into a staff room and heard teachers thinking aloud about what they're doing? It's just not safe. We don't often do it. And that's the problem. We don't see those occurrences. Of course, thinking is inside a kid's head, so it's not easy to see. You have to create situations to hear it. And that's what we struggle to find any instance of.
Well, I hope it's happening in my classroom, but...
No, it is true. It's easy to prove that there's achievement going on, right, Tim? But it's a little bit more difficult to show that learning has happened. And
that's right. So, I'm agreeing with you. What do you do when you don't know what to do is the question you ask the kids. And if they sit back and say, I don't know, you know you've got a kid that's not a good learner.
I know. One of the things that is my big goal, for example, in spelling, I know spelling isn't one of the most crucial skills in the world, but I want my kids to know when they don't know how to spell a word, because that's what we do as adults. I mean, I don't know how to spell every word, but I know when I don't know how to spell it, and then I have to either look it up or ask somebody else how to spell it. And so that's really what I want my kids doing, is kind of that metacognition level of saying, wait a minute, do I even know how to spell this word?
And you're absolutely right, particularly with spelling. It's all about error detection. People who can't spell don't know that the words are misspelled.
Right.
Whereas we can, and that error detection is true in math, it's true in history, it's true in panel beating, you name it. It's that ability to know you've made a mistake and pause and say, wait a moment, Whereas the kid who is struggling through the work, they don't know when it's a mistake, when it's not a mistake. This is why I'm a little obsessed about success criteria, showing kids what excellence looks like so that they've got some goalposts to work to. And so they know that what they're doing isn't up to standard. So they are able to become learning detectives.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Hattie, in a classroom setting, does that look like a micro example where I show one single example to kids and then see if they understand or can explain how I got there, and then they try? I mean, what does that look like in a classroom, when, like, maybe on a little micro level?
Well, certainly it means that somewhere near the beginning of a series of lessons, you should be showing the kids what a worked example of what excellence is, what it is you're aiming for. It should not be the situation that the kid has to guess what's in your mind about what's okay. They take math, for example. Sometimes in math, give the kid the answer, so they focus on the process of getting there. But they don't think that doing math is getting everything right. It's about detecting how short they're going relative to getting the answer correct, where they get stuck in these steps, et cetera, so that you actually focus on the process of learning. And so showing them what that success looks like is really extremely powerful. And when you see it happen, it's really quite exciting, because then kids can become part of that equation. We also do a lot of work where we have kids become learning detectives. We say, your job today is to notice occasions when other kids are actually going through the struggle of learning. And the struggle of learning is a good thing. And so, to, again, highlight and privilege that it's okay to make mistakes, and errors are opportunities. Where if you ask most kids and most teachers what happens when you make a mistake, they say, oh, I got it wrong, that's no good. Actually, that's the point of learning. And if you're not making mistakes, then you're probably not at the edge of learning. And unfortunately, a lot of kids, particularly our above-average kids, love to wallow in the safety of doing what they could do yesterday.
Oh, yeah. It feels a lot better. And, you know, that's hard for kids. I mean, they're used to – they want to see those stars on their paper, the 100%, right?
That's right. That's right. And the perfect test for a kid is for each kid gets 50% right and 50% wrong. And that's a tough thing to sell. But that's when you know you're at the edge of what you know and you don't know. And then as you obviously would – appreciate, that's where the trust and relationships come in, for that safe for kids to fail. And in many classes, it's not safe to fail.
Yeah, I think it's even harder for the parents to see that than for the kids sometimes, too.
Oh, so true. That's one of the problems with a lot of gifted kids, is their parents won't let them fail. They won't let them go into new challenges. And they see that as a sign of weakness. It is the essence of what that learner is. And if you're not prepared to make mistakes, clearly you're not going to be in the situation of learning. Let's get real, guys. You don't go to school to learn the stuff you know.
Oh, that's so true. So true.
Dr. Hattie, at what point, though, do we do a disservice if the kids are making too much mistakes? I mean, there's a fine line there, right, between taking something and then almost developing a problem or a misconception in that child that they have to fight the rest of their life. For example, I cannot to this day spell sincerely correctly, because I learned it incorrectly. I learned it incorrectly at the beginning, and now I'm kind of stuck with that, and I have to continue to, like, self-correct when I use that word. So is there a point where we need to stop kids, jump in, inconvene, and then get them off of any misconceptions, or do we just let them mistake until they discover it on their own?
No, that's why you're there, is that skill of knowing when to go in and when not to go in, and it comes down to that Goldilocks principle. I used to argue the Goldilocks principle was not too easy, not too hard, but a group of researchers from California last year showed me their research, which showed I was wrong on that. Goldilocks is not too easy, sorry, starting it, not too hard, not too boring.
Yeah.
Kids will do remarkable things if they're invested in learning. And if you don't believe me, watch them play video games. And so how do you make the task appropriately challenging and appropriately interesting? And then kids will make more mistakes. And it's okay. But there is absolutely a skill and an art of moving in at the right time and giving the kids. Like with you, with sincerely, I'd say to you, look, come on, guys, don't use that word. Use another word. as opposed to, let's overlearn something that you've already overlearned. And sometimes we survive very well by doing something different as opposed to just repeating the mistakes we've already made.
Yeah, that's the strategy I learned from being a poor speller, is to find different words and expand my vocabulary. So I'm actually a better writer because of it.
So all your letters now finish yours faithfully.
Yeah. Okay, hey, Dr. Hattie, can I ask you kind of a strange question here? But Scott and I both have a great amount of respect for you and your knowledge of education and just the world out there of education. I mean, I just feel so limited by, you know, just, I mean, I'm busy teaching every day. So can you recommend for our listeners, who are you a fan of? Who do you like out there that are good researchers, that are good, you know, education gurus that you go to and that you really like the stuff that they're up to?
Yeah, I do have a group of go-tos. Mary Kennedy from Michigan. I think she's a stunning. I've never met the lady, but wow. She just sees the world of research so differently. And so I have a thing on my computer system that every time she publishes something, I get it immediately. I'm a great fan of Bob Mazzano and his work. Obviously, we have very similar ways in which we do our research, but he's very, very good at translating it. And that's the skill that I admire in others. Michael Pullen has the same kind of notion. There are newer researchers. Jenny Donahue's coming on. Peter DeWitt. Great translators of the research. And that, I'm probably telling you what my weakness is I'm not bad at doing the research side, but the translation side I struggle a bit with. And so I look for people who are very good at translating the work and moving it into the classroom situation. James Nottingham in the UK, stunning in terms of how he's taken some of these ideas and turned it into practice.
Yeah. What about Dylan William? What do you think of him?
Oh, look, I think he's excellent.
Yeah.
I think his work is really stunning. He's got great insight. Obviously, he and I come from similar backgrounds in terms of measurement, but I've followed his work over the years. We disagree on a lot of things, but that's one of the beauties of someone like Dylan. He's extremely smart, good. He's a great writer. His work just came out a couple of days ago. He just has a way of saying things and putting them in perspective that's really quite refreshing.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. That's fun to hear from you because we, like I say, Scott and I just have such a high regard for your work. So,
hey,
thank you.
Dr. Hattie, are there any myths out there that teachers need to avoid? There's so many different practices that are being shut out from social media to online websites, anything like that. Are there any myths on how we actually are making our impact that we should try to avoid as teachers that you've seen through your research?
Yeah, unfortunately, our business is full of them. And it's this notion of the number of... It's really interesting when you look at what the media, what teachers talk about. They love to talk about the things that have the least impact. And that's one of the struggles out there. Like, there's a whole lot of myths in terms of the learning aerials and nonsense about learning styles, over-obsession about some of the labelling that we have on kids as if labelling them solves the problem. Nothing wrong with labelling if it's the first step in diagnosis and intervention, but too often we love to label a kid and say that's why the kid can't. And I just struggle with the debates that we have in our business because then too often they don't matter. Like, we have a whole profession that tends to deny its own expertise. And I look around, and in fact, this is what keeps me going. I see some stunning teaching and some stunning schools out there. And if you listen to the rhetoric and you go to teachers' conferences, it's always about the failures. When are we ever going to learn to scale up our success? And so it's probably not a myth, but it's that notion that we have that success. We are very, very good in general about what we do. And how do we capture that and grow it as opposed to denigrate the profession, look to all the apps and the resources as if they're the answers, look to the nonsense of best practices if best practice is the answer, not the person and the interpretation of the person doing the best practice. We're very good at being distracted, I'm afraid.
Well, I think we're about at that point now. We're going to change gears with you if you don't mind. I mean, Scott and I both feel like we could talk to you all day long and just ask you a million questions. Yeah. But let's play a little game with you right now to kind of lighten things up. And
sure.
So you are one of the global leaders in looking at education research, but are you able to recognize some of the biggest research blunders in recent history? Today, we're going to ask you three questions about research errors that made it big in a game that we're calling You Better Re-Research That. Scott, tell our audience who Dr. Hattie will be competing for today.
Dr. Hattie, you're going to be competing for Kristen Gregg, a fourth grade teacher in Orange County, California. And if you're able to answer two out of the three questions correctly, Kristen will be awarded a free premium account from the great people at ListenWise, the award-winning tool that brings teachers the best NPR content and connects it right there for them. They'll also receive a download of the ridiculously popular edgy rock band, Rockin' the Standards.
All right, so here we go, Dr. Hattie, with question number one. about research blunders. In 1990, in an article in Science magazine, Carl Sagan, have you heard of him?
Yes.
Okay. And his original co-authors admitted that their initial temperature estimates of a nuclear winter, should there be an all-out nuclear war, were wrong. Their corrected conclusion stated that an all-out nuclear war could reduce average temperatures at the most by how many degrees? Is it A?
17 degrees Celsius or Fahrenheit, your choice.
What? Wait a minute. We got to pick one. Okay, or is it B?
36 degrees.
Or is it C?
700 degrees.
So your choices are 17 degrees, the temperature would go down during a nuclear winter. Is this Celsius or Fahrenheit? Do we know?
This is Celsius, Tim.
This is Celsius.
What the world uses.
17 degrees Celsius, 36 degrees Celsius, or 700 degrees Celsius?
Well, it can't be 700 degrees if the Kelvin scale exists. So I'm going to go for B, Kristen.
Okay, 36 degrees. That is correct. Okay. You know your nuclear winters. Okay, number two. U.S. National Institutes of Health investigatory.
That's easy for you today.
Woo! Investigatory panel found Teresa Imanashi Carey had fabricated data in a 1986 research paper authored with the Nobel Prize winner David Baltimore. What was their research paper on? Was it on A?
Cloning the human genome.
Was it on B?
Vaccine effectiveness.
Or was it C?
Genetic modifications of the immune system.
Okay, so your three choices are cloning the human genome, vaccine effectiveness, and genetic modification of the immune system.
It's got to be C.
Wow, you're good at this.
Oh, yes. Christine, we've done it.
Yeah, you did.
I'm just terrified. Bacteria is the next one going to be own research.
Oh, no.
Oh, good.
It is not your research.
Learning styles. Okay. Here we go. Number three. In 1981, now former Harvard researcher John Darcy, I assume he goes by Mr. Darcy.
Doctor.
Okay. Was found to be faking data in a heart study. Eventually, investigators at the National Institute of Health discovered that data for most of his studies in his career had been fabricated. Can you imagine? He's fabricated almost all of his research. How many published studies did John Darcy fake? How many different studies did he fake? So is it A?
Less than 10.
Is it B?
About 50.
Or do you think it's C?
Nearly 100.
All right, so John Darcy, how many fake studies did he put out? 10, about 50, or nearly 100?
Well, as you said, he could probably sit there all day and just invent data, so I'm going to go for the larger number, 100.
Wow, there you got it. You got
Speaking
it again.
Of 100, that's 100%.
You got 100% on that quiz. That's very random.
I love it. Well, I hope Christine enjoys those prizes from that.
Well, Scott, tell our listeners about what just happened there.
Okay, good job, Dr. Hattie. You got 3 out of 3 correct, and that's good enough to be a winner. Congratulations, you won nothing. But Kristen, she just won a free premium account from ListenWise, an amazing site you need to check out, and a download of the ridiculously popular Rockin' the Standards album, Education, Rock and Roll Music for 2nd through 6th graders. Dr. Hattie, it's an honor again to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Can you tell our listeners how they can learn more from you?
Well, obviously this program, I'm churning out the books, and I'm sitting in that back room doing it and loving that. So there's more books coming out, and I do get around your part of the country a few days each year. So I'd love to see you and talk to more about how we implement this kind of work. It's quite as exciting and fun. Thank you.
Yeah, and do you actually, are you doing keynotes at some education conferences out in the United States or what?
Well, because I live in a million miles away from you guys, I do about 30 days traveling a year. So I do get to the States for about a week, 2 weeks every year, various places. But I'm not a great traveler, as you can imagine, from this part of the world. But I do get over every now and then, yes.
Yeah, and how can they find out where you will be? Is there something on your website that says where you're going to be presenting?
Yeah, I actually don't run a website. Isn't that terrible? I have a group I work with that does it in a competition in Auckland, and they usually say where I'm going or where I'm not going. But I do get obsessed about some of the things I do, and if I got onto a website, I'd probably spend all my time doing that.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. All right. Well, thanks again for being on the show with us, and most of all, thanks for listening.
Mom and Dad.
Mom and Dad.
Yeah. Bedley Brothers, Bedley, Bedley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Bedley Brothers, Bedley, Bedley Brothers.